This morning, we're going to cover two very different topics in response to recent questions. First, we're going to talk about wine at the crucifixion, just to get a survey of what's there and what's unclear. And then we're going to talk about some misconceptions about Satan and where they might come from, and look at some scriptures and see what role, what he does and what he perhaps doesn't do that's just popular culture or later theology creating things. So this is where we're going to start. These are the crucifixion scenes within the four Gospels. We're going to start with Mark. So if you would, turn to Mark 15. We probably won't actually go to Luke, so you don't really have to turn there. But just so you know, that's where all of this is discussed there. There are some things to figure out in relation to the how the gospel narratives interact regarding the crucifixion. Jonathan was asking about the wine. I thought I would talk about it some. You've got two or possibly three different things related to wine in trying to give Jesus wine in the gospel narratives. The first one is in Mark 15:23. We look at 21, and they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the follower of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross, and they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. So the first wine that is offered to Jesus is a wine that he's offered before he's crucified, right? This is something that, not while he's on the cross, but before the cross. It says here that he's offered wine mixed with myrrh. Now, what most people point out, at least in the commentaries I read and the comments I saw online, what most people point out is that adding myrrh to the wine would basically be a pain suppressant. It would dull some of the pain that Jesus would feel on the cross. Notice he refuses that here. I'm actually not entirely sure that's true. In terms of effect, it probably is. But notice he does actually deny that. Now, if we keep reading, we will see the next instance here, or at least what is for sure another instance, because this one shows up in all four Gospels. So if we keep reading, verse 25, and it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews, and with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left, and those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see if Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." So this gift of wine was a gift of sour wine. Wine drinkers will probably know about sour wine. What's going on with that? Anybody? What happens when a wine turns sour? What's going on?
It's vinegar. It's oxidized. It's lost its seal, and it will eventually turn into vinegar and lose its potency.
That's right. So it's, once you get through the basic fermentation process, from what I understand, right? You need to get you need to get the wine to a point where it is no longer oxidized. It doesn't have a lot of oxygen getting into it. And so if the seal is bad, a lot of oxygen can get in there, and ultimately that wine will turn into vinegar. Okay? And as this process goes on, it would get more and more sour. And so they give Jesus this kind of wine on the cross. Right? Why this kind of wine? Well, commentators have said, and this makes a lot of sense to me, that this is the kind of wine you would generally give to the poor. Why would you give sour wine to the poor? It's not as good. You know, if you are wealthy and you open up some wine and you go, wow, this batch is sour, you're not going to continue drinking that wine. All right? You might give that away. Right? If you were to open a bottle of wine today and it was entirely turned to vinegar, are you going to drink it, wine drinkers? Probably not. Yeah, Chip?
Isn't there one solution to muscle cramps, drinking pickle juice and vinegar, that boosts your electrolytes?
You know, I've heard that it... I read, and honestly, I'm not sure when the commentators talk about these things, I'm not actually sure how well they know. But some of them said that this would really quench thirst better than perhaps regular wine, which I'm kind of skeptical. That's a particular option that maybe it would help with cramps. Honestly, don't know. So I actually can't say for sure what the function of this otherwise, other than it was given, and he did, in fact, drink it. It's not clear from Mark that he drank it. It is clear from the Gospel of John that he did, and so we'll probably turn there and read it. When I read, you know, when you read commentators, sometimes you can read them and see how they deal with evidence and go, oh yeah, they're really dealing with real evidence here. Sometimes you read them and go, oh, they're making statements. I don't see anything that backs it up. I haven't seen anything yet that really backs up and really has a strong argument. But that may just be my particular resources. They didn't seem to focus on it much, and so it wasn't a huge concern for whatever reason. Yeah?
In Mark, it says that he was talking, and it's like they couldn't understand what he was saying. Behold, he's calling Elijah, and someone ran and killed him. Almost like they want to wet his lips so they can understand what he's saying better.
Could be. Maybe the tongue's too swollen, and he's hard to understand. That's a reasonable explanation.
Yeah. If he's on the cross, if he's going to have a terrible, shameful pain, why are they giving him something that could relieve his cramps?
So that's a good question. It depends on who's doing the giving. In one of the gospel accounts, it does identify this as a soldier. Most of them, I think, it just says like passerby or someone around. I don't recall if that was Mark that identified him as a soldier. It could be the individual soldiers would be having mercy. Certainly passerbys would sometimes have mercy on those who were there, right? We know that there were people sympathetic, women sympathetic to Jesus being there, right? We know that the disciple whom Jesus loved was there at the cross. And so it wasn't just people who were antagonistic to him. Though there were plenty of those. There were plenty mocking him, right? And there were, of course, soldiers. That's also clear. So there's a crowd there, right? The soldiers are going to be there to, of course, keep you from taking people off the cross, right? That's going to be a function for them. Sometimes they might have mercy. Oftentimes, they're not going to. Which is one reason why I wonder why they would try to give Jesus wine mixed with myrrh if that would deaden the pain. Maybe so he would live longer, so he would ultimately be tortured more. Maybe. But I think it's an open question. There's one other I want to show you, and then let's turn to Matthew 27. Matthew has this same sour wine incident. He does not have something that says wine mixed with myrrh. In verse 33, it says this. And this is in about the same place where it talked about the wine mixed with myrrh in Mark. Because right before this, it talks about Simon of Cyrene. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. And when he tasted it, he would not drink it. Right? So it seems to be the same thing as myrrh. At least in the narrative, it's taking the same place. One thing that makes me pause on the explanations here, and since it was asked, I just thought I'd go ahead and bring it up, but just leave it open, in that one classical source I read, though they unfortunately did not go into any detail at all, which is not helpful, they pointed out that this was not something that would deaden pain and be a mercy to them. This would actually harm them. Now, generally speaking, when we're looking at, if you want to figure out crucifixions from a Roman torture standpoint, classicists would be a group that would often be very concerned with that. So that makes me wonder if, at least the commentaries I read, and I read some rather academic commentaries, they just weren't really doing the spade work, weren't really, really digging into it. Because some of them would just mention things and just kind of move on. So all of that is to say, I think this is the same thing as the myrrh, because it's in the same place in the narrative. But I'm skeptical that it plays the role that people sometimes assign to it. Yeah?
Yeah, what's a classicist?
Good question. So, who studies the ancient world? All right, two people, at least in terms of Greek and Roman. There's two sets of people that study this time period. There's Christians, because the New Testament was written in this time period. Understanding the culture around is actually super important. And then there's classicists. These are people who are very interested in ancient Greek and Rome, not from a religious standpoint, because I don't know any polytheistic classicist, just from a academic or Western culture or historical standpoint. They learn Greek, they learn Latin, they're not trying to read the Greek of the New Testament. That's low Greek, that's not great Greek. We'll read Plato, we'll read Aristotle, right? We don't want to read the Latin of the Vulgate. We'll read Seneca, we'll read Livy, we'll read Ovid. And so they're very concerned with language and history and culture and all that, but it's for a very different purpose. Sometimes these groups overlap, because there is a very useful overlap there, right? I find both of them very interesting. But classicists as a discipline, all right, are also very valuable, because they're not coming to that time period trying to go for a understanding of a specific document, like Christians who study classics often are. They're much more broad. They're like, I just want to understand Rome and everything they did. So that's what a classicist is. So when a classicist says, this is not a merciful thing to do to Jesus, that makes me go, okay, then why is nobody in the Bible commentaries really discussing that? Is there an argument and a debate that I'm missing, and perhaps they're missing, which is not unusual for that kind of thing to happen? Because even though the groups are in the same area, often they don't read each other's literature because they don't care about the other group.
What's the difference between wine mixed with gall and wine mixed with myrrh?
That is the question I don't know. That's the thing I'm trying to say I don't have an answer for.
Then what is gall?
Gall is generally referred to something that'll make something bitter and can sometimes be used in poisons.
Out of like wormwood?
I think it's probably similar to that, yeah.
Okay.
Chip. It's interesting. I don't know. They didn't mention it. None that I read. So if anybody's looking for research, my recommendation would be, hey, here's something for you to research. It would be something interesting. But you're probably going to need a really good lending library to go to, or better internet skills than I had, because I couldn't find anything useful online, which is not unusual. Yeah.
In the Luke account is the one where it says it is the soldiers that give it to him, and it says the sour wine, not the one that takes the gall. And it says
that's
that
right.
They were mocking him and they gave it to him. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
It is linked with mocking instead of like humiliation or suffering.
Yeah. Like, ha, take this sour wine because you don't deserve good wine because you're up there. But he does drink it, though. And so it is something he does end up, in that sense, appreciating. And just so we see that, let's go to John 19. And then we'll leave this topic and talk about something else. John 19, verse 29, or of 28. This is a good place to start. After this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished, said, to fulfill the scripture, "I thirst." A jar full of sour wine stood there, so they put a sponge full of sour wine on a hyssop branch and held it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the sour wine, that's the more explicit statement of, okay, he received it. He didn't turn it away. You know. He said, "It is finished," and he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And so it did not, in fact, if you want to read it as a revitalizing thing, that's not actually what happened. He, according to the John account, did actually die shortly after or immediately after receiving the wine. There are open questions here. You like for things to be definitive. I'm not seeing definitive things. So that's enough of that. If I find something definitive, I'll share it later. Let's change subjects entirely. Turn to Job chapter 1. No, it is not mentioned. Yeah. You guys know the story of Job, hopefully, right? Job is a righteous man. He has much, very, very much. And then Satan, all right, talks to God, says, "This guy who supposedly is faithful to you is only faithful to you because you have given him so much." And of course, God says, "Well, that's not true. Test him." All right? Test him, and we'll find out. And as we do find out, ultimately, Job is indeed a righteous man. Job chapter 1, verse 6. This is about that. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan," or the Satan, "also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house, and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." And ultimately, Satan gets proved wrong here. And then later, he is actually allowed to touch Job himself. As I think it was Edward mentioned recently, you know, a lot of people say that Job is, you know, possibly the earliest thing, the earliest story we have in the Old Testament. I think it might have been you that said that recently. It's a very common thought, and one of the reasons why is it really appears to be pre-Mosaic. Right? It doesn't appear to take place, if you read the story, after the giving of the law. And if that's the case, then, well, that means this is incredibly old, because most of the Old Testament, right, is Exodus, and afterwards it is post-Moses. If that's the case, and that's relevant, you'll see why in a sec, then this is our, potentially, our earliest time-wise, depiction of Satan or a Satan-type figure in the Old Testament. All right? Now, I say his name is Satan or he is the Satan because, from an Old Testament perspective, Satan doesn't show up very much. And the word Satan itself just means, essentially, adversary. All right? It isn't necessarily a name. And some people would argue here it's not a name. That it is just a title. He is the Satan. He has a role as like a prosecuting attorney, a role that he takes in Zechariah. He has a role to accuse. All right? And so that's exactly what he does here, right? God says, "If you've seen my servant Job," and he's like, "Job's not that great. He's really not that great. It's just because you give it, you baby him. You protect him. That's the only reason he's righteous." So he takes that kind of role. Another example, turn to the book of Numbers. You say something?
Yeah, interesting thing here that kind of stuck out to me is if this is Satan or Satan-like figure, they're almost maybe not welcomed into heaven with full arms, but they at least seem to be on some form of neutral terms.
Yeah, he is here with God. Yeah.
Which seems very weird. He is a fallen demon. With the intent to destroy God.
Generally speaking, in Christian theology, when did the fall of Satan happen? And they will say it was, for a decent reason, it was after creation. Why? Because when God had created, he said everything was good. All right? Now, that might only be a statement about physical creation, not spiritual creation. But still, that's a common argument people say. Well, if it was after that, when did the fall happen? Well, if Satan is the serpent, then it would be after the creation. It would be after Genesis 1 and 2 and before Genesis 3, essentially. Which would mean by the time you get to this point, he is most certainly fallen, but he can still go into the presence of God and have some sort of role there. It's curious. And for some, would be an argument why this is not Satan, this is the accuser. He is a functionary of God going to do a role. I tend to believe this is actually Satan, but it is worth mentioning.
So taking this from the position that this is actually Satan, does Satan get passed down like he does in Revelation? Cast down from God onto the earth, and he can't go back into heaven?
Not in Job. It really has to be, and we were going to get to this, but you've got in the book of Revelation, you've got Satan, you've got the dragon, and many of his minions cast out of heaven. There's a war, Revelation 12. There's a war, all right, and they are cast out of heaven. You also see in the Gospels, all right, where Jesus says, you remember this statement? I see Satan falling from heaven, all right? Why? Well, the function of this, and this is a very common theme in the Gospels, is what's happening with the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of Satan. And Jesus' activity in the Gospels is a direct attack against Satan. And so when he's doing things, he is actually in the process of defeating him. And so when I think of Revelation in terms of that war, in the actual casting out, I tend to put that within the life of Jesus. That's not the fall per se. That is Satan and in his strength being cast down to the earth at the time of Christ. I think so. But it's hard to say. Yes. That period of time. Yeah.
Keep in mind, often whenever we think heaven, we think about Revelation throne room scenes, and that could be the case. But also remember this idea that I've tried to share with y'all before about God's space. It's just the place that humans do not have access to.
Yeah.
But that's a human problem, not a spiritual problem. In other words, angels have access to God's space, and they also have access to man's space.
Mm-hmm.
God also does, but humans don't.
Yeah.
We come, we have access to God through Christ, because Christ was a man.
So Satan could still have his power, his angelic power is not fully taken away from him.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, that is the New Testament position. That has Satan been defeated? Yes. Is he still something to be feared? Yes. His power of death over us, it is decisively broken for all of those who believe in Christ. Problem solved, right? Ultimately, the problem is solved and it's over with. He cannot defeat Christ. Christ himself was, in fact, vindicated and came out of the grave. And so, does Satan exist? Yes. Is he dangerous? We'll get into his role when we read some from the New Testament, assuming we have enough time. We will. Is he unstoppable? No. He's certainly defeatable. Numbers 22, real quick. Like I said, the word for Satan is not a huge thing in the Old Testament. You actually have it show up here, but nobody translates it, as far as I know, as Satan here. Numbers 22, verse 22. But God's anger, so this is Balaam. All right, remember the Balaam and the talking donkey? But God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his Satan. All right, I told you the word Satan just means adversary. In this particular case, this is the angel of the Lord as his adversary. All right, which, does this mean just the generic term for adversary, or was Satan actually having to do the bidding here? I don't think so. I think it just means simply adversary. There's some other instances, like, for example, in Zechariah, I already mentioned that. Satan, or the accuser, accuses the high priest. And you also have, and we won't read this, but you can go back to it. 1 Chronicles 21, versus 2 Samuel 24. This would be the incident where David does a census of the people. All right? This is not something he was supposed to do. All right? This ended in disaster for David. What was it? Well, if you look in 1 Chronicles, you see it is Satan inciting David. If you look in 2 Samuel, you will see that it is the Lord inciting David to do this. Generally, most people say, what's going on here? Which one is it? It's God using Satan as a tool to bring this about. But I encourage you to check it out. These are one of just the few instances where really Satan shows up in the Old Testament. Of course, you do have the serpent. Generally speaking, if you think about the Old Testament, they don't think of the serpent as an incarnate satanic being. All right, it really isn't until later, until the New Testament, where you get Satan identified with the serpent. If you read just Genesis without thinking about Satan, all right, and this, I won't go to that. If you think about it just as, all right, Adam and Eve interacting with an animal, all right, it is not explicitly presented as a satanic act. It's presented as it's a serpent. He is intelligent, all right, and can speak. But after this, what happens? Well, the serpent is in fact cursed because of his role there. Later on, as a part of Christian theology, we recognize, right, and we see in the New Testament, identifying Satan as actually that serpent. So when you look in the Old Testament, there's actually not a lot of theology based on or based around defining Satan. In the intertestamental period between the Old Testament and the New, lots of Jews talked about it. And when you're in the New Testament, you see Satan come up quite a bit. Turn to the Gospels. I just want to read a few things here in just a second. What does Satan look like in your brain? Here's a better one. What is Satan always holding?
A pitchfork that's red.
a red pitchfork. Okay?
Scripture says he's an angel of light.
Yes. Scripture never says he's carrying a pitchfork. Well, this is not a trident. This is a
bident.
This is a bident, all right? This is often how we view Satan. Horns, red, carrying a bident, all right? Do you happen to know what classical figure, what classical god, was associated with carrying a bident? What's that?
Ares.
God of war. All right. Who else?
Poseidon is shown with a trident.
Trident. Poseidon, he's a water guy. Different guy.
Right.
Hades. All right. What's really interesting about this one specifically, all right, I don't know if Ares carries, maybe he does. Hades certainly does in classical mythology. He will sometimes have Hades. Now, what is Hades' role? What does he do? What's that? He's the god of the underworld. Is he a nice guy?
He's a bad guy.
He's not a good guy. His job is, and this gets directly to your question last time, one of his jobs is to do kind of mean things to bad people in the underworld. All right? That's Hades. That is not Satan. All right? So this idea that the satanic figure, his job is in hell to torture people, this, I really think, is entirely brought over from Greek Hades. Now, why would you do that? All right? There's actually really good reason to do it. Take that back. That's the wrong way to say it. It's understandable that this would happen, but it is not a good idea, is really the way to say it. Hades is both a person and a place, right? He's not just a person. Think of the person as like the place personified. Hades shows up a lot in the Bible. You may not, depending on your translation, you won't see it, but it shows up a lot in the Bible. Not the God. The God never shows up in the Bible. The place called Hades actually shows up a ton in both the Old and the New. Now, this is a Greek idea. How do we know that the Greek idea of Hades, why would that show up in the Old Testament? Well, you might have already put these two things together, but if you're going to, for example, say, take the Old Testament, and you translate that Old Testament to another language so people can understand it, and you've got this nice word ready for you that already means underworld, where people go when they die, namely Hades, it's actually very natural for you to translate Sheol, which does show up probably a lot in your English translations. It's just translate Sheol as Hades. And that is exactly what the Septuagint translators often did. And so if you are a Greek-speaking person in the first century, and you're reading your Old Testament, and you, like most Greek-speaking people, don't know Hebrew, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to find that David actually goes to Sheol. No, he doesn't. He goes to Hades. And you will sometimes see that, for example, even in translations. Like, for example, some translations say whenever Peter is preaching to the crowd about David, and they will translate it and say, "You did not abandon my soul to where?" To Hades. And so naturally, you're going to have, as part of the Septuagint, and then in the New Testament, when it talks about that place where people go when they die, Hades is typically the word. Not because the New Testament authors believed in Hades, the Greek conception of Hades. No, they didn't do that. But they used that word. All right. Now, Hades, as a term, so there's your bident. That is entirely non-biblical. That is just Greek stuff later brought over. Hades, the next thing to recognize, this is programming language, this is not equals, all right? It does not, there's not a strict equation between Hades and when people in English talk about the word hell, all right? There's also another term, right? The lake of fire, okay, which is also not necessarily the same thing as Hades. Well, what tends to happen is these people tend to combine these things when sometimes they're distinguished. Like, for example, the rich man and Lazarus. All right? Where is the rich man? He's in Hades. Where's Lazarus? He's at Abraham's side, right? Is that in Hades?
Yes.
I tend to think so, all right? But the part that Lazarus is in is it's torturous, right? Where the rich man is, it's torturous. Where Lazarus is, it's actually a great place to be, right? It's a place of blessing, and it's a place of waiting, all right? Waiting for what? Well, ultimately for the resurrection. Okay? At least that's the idea at the time. Yeah.
So you're saying there's two parts of Hades. A place where maybe hell, like fire, where all the torture goes on. And then the place where not heaven, but like, not Pentecost. What was the way the place started with P?
Purgatory.
Purgatory?
Purgatory would be a even later idea, right? Where purgatory is a place of torture, but is a place of suffering to get you ready for heaven. It is not something that's taught in the New Testament at all. Yeah, that is a later medieval conception. We're going to go back to Satan here in a second. All I'm pointing out is there is a mass of unclear terminology here, all right, that is worth, once again, a full study. All right. You don't see Hades when you read your English translations, all right? And so therefore, at least as far as I know, if you read in Greek, you'll see it all the time. This equation is partially happening because of that particular word choice, all right? And it's not because when Jesus is speaking and he talks about Hades, he wants people to believe in the Greek conception of Hades. No, Jesus is a Jew. He would have understood Hades more like Sheol, right? That's where he's coming, that's where he comes from, right? That's where the concept of Sheol comes from. Sheol comes from the Old Testament, ultimately comes from God, that conception, not Hades. Hades as a term, all right, is going to be essentially a translation term to talk about the underworld. We've got a nice Greek word for that underworld, and there we have it. Now, I won't go there. The idea, or in other words, to answer Jennifer's question, the idea that Satan is ultimately involved in the torture of people, right, is certainly not a New Testament idea, at least nothing that I've seen. You've got it clearly later, and I didn't have time this morning to look it up. There's a hymn, maybe you guys know it, John Newton. It's called The Day of Judgment, Day of Wonders. Anybody familiar with that hymn? It's got a line, and this would have been from 1774, where he explicitly, for this hymn, so those churches, therefore, that sing this hymn are going to, look at it this way, where Satan is the one who plunges you into the burning lake. Think, poor sinner, but all that's at stake, right? That's him. You see Satan torturing people in Dante's Divine Comedy, which I've read part of. You see it apparently in Milton's Paradise Lost, which I have not read because I am poorly educated. But it is supposedly there. Right? And so this does come into the Western canon. All right? But I think ultimately the source is extra-biblical. It's the Hades-Sheol connection that really makes that happen. So you don't see it in the New Testament unless somebody can find something that I don't know about. You do clearly see it much later based on that connection. Make sense? So you don't have to worry about that. That's not his role at all. All right? In Christian theology, afterlife punishment is something that, to be clear, God does. All right? And that includes Satan. All right? Who's the lake of fire made for? It's made for Satan and his angels. Right? That's New Testament theology, right? In terms of Satan.
Now, is the Tom and Jerry, a little devil on the shoulder, or Tom and Jerry hell that they sometimes fall in, an extension of the Hades idea?
I don't think so. But when they picture that little demon with a bident, then yes. All right? I think it's that. Because in Greek mythology, Hades was not constantly tempting you. Right? What that probably is taking, it's now mixing devil stuff with true Christian theology. Right? Because one of the functions in the New Testament of Satan is, in fact, to be the tempter. You, of course, see that in the temptation of Jesus, right? Satan comes to tempt Jesus, and he is called the tempter. Now, I read on the Billy Graham website something that is false, and I want to go ahead and call it out. I don't know if he wrote it, but it was on his website. There is this statement, and this is actually about Matthew 4:3. The Bible declares that the devil is the source of all temptation and is called the tempter. All right? This is clearly a role of Satan in the New Testament. It shows up multiple times, and I've got various places to read, which I think we'll just read some next time. This is a role of Satan, all right? But he is not the source of all temptation, all right? There's another huge source of temptation in your life, all right, that causes you to stumble. And it is who? What's that? It's you. It is your fallen nature. James says, and this is an easy way to refute this, right? James says, you sin because you are tempted by yourself. It's very clear, right? Where does temptation come from for James? His focus was not Satan. His focus was, you're tempted because of your own desires and your own jealousy of others, right? That's where sin ultimately comes from there. So you actually have multiple sources. So Satan does perform that function. In college, there was a very popular book, and really became popular in high school. It's called This Present Darkness. And basically the whole premise of the thing was, whenever people were tempted by anything, greed, lust, theft, whatever, it was always a demon that was ultimately behind that notion. All right? I've got a demon of lust that's bothering me. I need to cast out this demon of lust. It's from this false notion that all temptation is ultimately from Satan. All right? This is clearly, biblically speaking, this is clearly false. All right? The original temptation, okay, that came from Satan. But the New Testament puts the blame in multiple places at the foot of the person, going, you're messed up. Satan can also tempt you. All right? Reality is, though, and this is, I think, another false conception we often have, Satan is not omniscient. Satan is not omnipresent. All right? Satan probably doesn't know who you are. Okay? We're not big stuff. But he does have minions. All right? And so he does have things that do his bidding. There is a spiritual world, and there is a war going on. And those things are actually involved in your life. But Satan is probably not sitting and whispering in your ear all the time, because there's a lot of people in this world, all right? And he can be in one place, right? He's not God. He is not omnipresent. He is not omniscient. And he is certainly not omnipotent, all right? He's more powerful than you and me, but he is not omnipotent. Yeah.
What about the preaching to the dead?
Good question. So, I think also something that was mentioned last time, and we'll have to end with this, right, is when Jesus died, did he go to hell? All right? This gets us into this whole terminological quagmire. All right? The Apostles' Creed, did Jesus go to hell? It entirely depends on your translation, actually. Where does he go? He goes to Hades. All right? Most translations tend to translate that as hell. And so you get this idea that Jesus went to hell to be punished. I don't see that in the New Testament. I don't think Jesus was punished in hell. Jesus took our death, right? As we discussed. He took our death so that we wouldn't have to be cursed with death as Christians. That happened. There's nothing that says he went and took all of our punishment in hell. Nothing that I've seen. And so that's kind of a later thing. And so what is actually totally makes sense, though, right, is what happened when Jesus died? He went to the place of the dead. He went to Sheol, right? And he was there for 3 days, right? What's he going to do? I would assume, right, that Abraham would be there. And there would be an announcement. That actually makes a lot of sense. It's not really filled out, right? There's that statement, which is in the Petrine epistles, right? There's that statement. And that Jesus does go to preach to the souls in Hades, right? That all makes sense, but it is not explicitly spelled out, right? This is not a major aspect of New Testament theology. It's not something they work through. They don't really need to, though. Where did Jesus go? Exactly where everyone else went, right, when they die. They go to Hades. They go to Sheol. The difference is between Jesus and them is what? Well, he didn't stay, right? Where was David? Well, Peter says, David's still dead. His body's still in its grave. This is different than Jesus himself, right? Were you going to say something?
You answered my question.
Okay. So there's some misunderstandings there. And I think there's some until some other evidence comes out that I think we can get away with and just say, this is gone. Satan will not torture people in hell. All right? Hell is made for Satan, however you want to conceive of that. Lake of fire, all right? It is made for him. It is not his tool, all right? It is not his abode. That's Greek mythology. That's Hades, all right? Pitchforks? No. The Far Side? I love The Far Side. They have lots of comics about hell, and all of them are wrong, because it's all about Satan holding a pitchfork, torturing people. Like my favorite, where Satan brings in a maestro and opens a door to a bunch of people playing banjos. It's fantastic. It's a great, but it's pop culture. It's brilliant. That's pop culture, all right? That is certainly not New Testament theology. Yeah.
This might be a question for, in case you do more of an in-depth Hades hell study, but would you agree that when Jesus told the people on the cross that he would be with them in paradise, mm-hmm. that was the other compartment of Hades where Abraham and Lazarus were sort of on the non-tormented side of Hades?
I think so. And I think that's probably the same thing when Paul says that he was taken to paradise as well. I think that's the same as well, but that's also not a... That's something that's hard to say because there's just so little information about it, right? Even the paradise aspect of Hades itself, there's not a lot in the New Testament about it, right? There's the Lazarus rich man. Is it a parable or is it a real story? You know, Bill's discussed this before, as we have. There's that. There's Paul going to paradise, right? And of course, heaven is presented as a paradise, but any sort of renewed heaven and earth paradise, that's something in the future. That's not something that Abraham experiences right now in Sheol. Yeah, Isaac?
Are
No. Yeah. I do believe you need to distinguish. Heaven is where God is. It is a non-physical place, all right? But I don't think we should equate that with the pleasant side of the place of the dead.
So that'd be interesting if Jesus is telling the thief, you'll be with me today in paradise, which is the good side of Hades, but then you'll stay there and I'll be resurrected.
Yeah.
It's not the way I've read it before, you know, it's promising him
to be in heaven.
Life.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Leave it at that, yeah. Jennifer?
So Hades is still holding people waiting to be judged. If I die tomorrow, I'll go to hopefully the good side of Hades.
That's a good question. We know from Hebrews, right, that after death comes judgment, right? Now, if we take the Lazarus rich man depiction as something we should take as a metaphysical reality, right? Then necessarily, the rich man got where he got because he was judged, right? And on the flip side, right, Abraham and Lazarus got what they got because they were also judged. And so, I can't think of anything that changes that situation at this point. Can you think of anything?
But what death did Jesus take? Like, his body died, my body's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the place of the dead,
mm-hmm.
where the dead humans
mm-hmm.
go.
Mm-hmm.
So then it would just be the final death. But he didn't die finally. It
seems like at the resurrection, people are.
That's the thing.
Yes, it's been obvious, but now's the time for you to be destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. You're still going to die. Right? The gospel does not tell you that you will not die. Jesus' death and resurrection did not change that. Right? Unless he comes back. That did not change that. You will still die. The thing is, you will not die eternally. That's the one he took. Going back to Athanasius' basic theological point, God made man so that man would live physically, right? So that man would live physically before God in a righteous way. That's what God intended. That's why Jesus had to become incarnate, and the extension of that is why there must be resurrection. Because if there is no incarnation, that can't be fixed. And if there is no resurrection, then Satan ultimately won. Right? And so, when we look at the state that people are in right now when they are dead, all right, there is good and there is bad, but it is not ultimate. Right? As we were discussing on our way here this morning when we were talking about Southern Gospel music has a very inordinate focus on being in the sweet by and by heaven, right? That's very strong within that particular genre of music. I don't see it, biblically speaking. That the focus, right? It's almost like for many people, The focus is, I get everything I was supposed to ever get as soon as I die. And that, I think, is definitely non-biblical. It's great, right? It's better to be absent from the body and present from the Lord. But that is not ultimately the end. The end is ultimately the reversal of eternal death for all of those who would believe in Christ. That's ultimately the end. And fixes the whole Sheol thing. Sheol should have never happened. Because nobody should have ever died. But they did because of sin. Does that make sense as a picture?
That is an encouragement, though. When Christians are absent from their bodies, they're with the Lord. Whatever
yeah.
that means, they're with him.
Yeah.
Which is the goal. We want to be with the Lord.
Yeah.
When Paul present with the Lord, that's way better than being alive right now and not continually in His presence in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Greek mythology, in Hades, you have, or at least from what I've seen and read, you have the three judges. Hades not always doing the judging.
Mm-hmm.
You have Midas and two others.
Rhadamanthus and one other.
Yeah.
That now I'm blanking on.
All other names.
Yeah.
That seems to pop up in other areas. Like uh-huh. I already mentioned Tom and Jerry. That you've got a judge on a pedestal, on a big pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
You have that in other cartoons. In my head, I've got a picture of Jesus sorting through just a big long line of people. More like bright light that's supposed to be God saying, hell, heaven. I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
Do you think like someone dies and God's already judged them, so they just, their soul just goes to...
Well, the judgment in a
culture reference.
A lot of it is, but the judgment is already known. If you go look at Revelation, right? Who is it that ultimately will receive life? It's those written in the book of life. When was the book of life written?
At the beginning of
time. Yeah, at the foundation of the world. And so, in actuality, how do you make that work? In actuality, in terms of time, judgment doesn't ultimately happen until death. But the reality is, it's not like God has to go through a big deliberation process. Right? This was decided and was written down as planned and known at the foundation of the world. Okay, we are definitely over time. If you have any other hell Satan questions, email me. All right, we'll talk about them next week because we talked a lot about Satan and his role without looking at a lot of scripture. I've got a number of things to read for us to read, all right, related to what he actually does. And so we will start off, Lord willing, our next discussion with that. If you have any specific things of how does this thing work, please email me. And so that way I will be sure to have time to study and have scriptures ready for you if there are for that notion, right? So just email me or catch me later today. Frank, will you pray for us, please?